Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, welcome to the midweek edition of the Manchester is Red podcast from the Manchester Evening News. I'm Tyro Marshall hosting today, joined by Samuel Luckhurst on a quiet week on the pitch for Manchester United. 9 days without a game from Burnley to Crystal Palace, but it's never quiet off the pitch at Old Trafford, and we will have plenty to talk about over the next 45 minutes or so. Samuel, how are you doing? Are you enjoying your quiet week, should we call it?
It's not felt too quiet, fortunately, which is just as well, given that, as you said, there's a bit of a news vacuum United-wise without any games, but that vacuum has quite quickly been filled, and it seems like those of us who are writing about them regularly in a dedicated capacity have had a lot to go at this week, and there have been a fair few things kicking about.
Yeah, there's always things going on with Manchester United, isn't it? We're going to discuss the transfer news that's come out this week that you've reported on, Samuel, the board changes that we saw last night, and then at the end we'll talk about the Manchester United player still in the Champions League. But let's start with everyone's favourite subject, which is transfers. Let's look at the incomings first. You reported earlier in the week three key signings wanted this summer. I mean, it's shaping up to be quite a strange summer in terms of the number of outgoings and maybe the number of incomings, but it feels like it's going to be, certainly where incomings are concerned, it's going to be quality over quantity probably this summer.
Well, I think with this, it is a strategy that they've operated quietly, I suppose, for 6 or 7 years, going back to the summer of 2017 when they bought three players: Lindelof, Lukaku, and Matic. Ibrahimovic, of course, was re-signed for the club as well. And bar that aberration in 2018, and then you had the exception of the 22 summer, they have been quite consistent with it. And even in that summer of 22, there were three major signings or significant signings, which were Martinez, Casemiro, and Antony. Tyron Malacia was a very cheap purchase. Was it 15 million euros, I think, or something like 12 point something million pounds. Christian Eriksen was a free. Martin Dubravka came in on loan. And although they invested the best part of 50 million pounds in Facundo Pellistri and Ahmad in 2020, that money was not completely up front. The Ahmad fee, I doubt it will rise to 37 million pounds just by virtue of his standing at United and the lack of opportunities he's had. And really the three significant signings that summer were that was autumn time, wasn't it, in October, because of the pandemic, were Van de Beek, Telles and Cavani. A year later, it's Sancho, Varane and Ronaldo. Last year, it was a lot more obvious in terms of the three key signings, which were Onana, Hoyland and Mount. The other four who came in, two were loanees. Johnny Evans was a free agent. Altay Bayandir, very cheap signing as well, £4 million, just over £4 million. So without many people knowing or noticing or knowing it, knowing that United operate this way, they have operated this way quite consistently. And even in that aberration in 2018, they did sign three players: Fred, Diogo Dalo, and Lee Grant. I would hesitate to say Lee Grant was a key signing or a significant signing, and I wouldn't have described Dalo as that either at the time. He was seen as very much a potential buy. Mourinho also wanted a winger that summer, and most infamously a centre back, who he didn't get. And a year later, it was Daniel James, Aaron Wan-Bissaka, and Harry Maguire, who were all quite firmly established almost from the get-go at United. And with this summer, you look at the team and as I reported, that the positions that are of paramount importance are centre back, central midfield, and a forward, which is totally understandable given that Garnacho and Hoyland are there for the foreseeable. They need a sharper, more reliable forward to complement them. And if you look at it that way in terms of three first team signings, there is logic to it in that Onana as well is going to be staying. Dallo is almost certainly going to be staying as the right back. If Luke Shaw is fit, then he's the left back. If Lisandro Martinez is fit, he's the other centre back. Kobbie Mainoo needs a new long-term partner in midfield. Bruno Fernandes is the captain. Garnacho is the left winger. Hoyland's the striker. And then you need another forward. But if is a very big word in the context of United, that the medical department need to sort themselves out. That has been a huge, huge issue this season. And they're not going to be able to get away with just three signings. I expect there to be more than just three signings, purely because there will be a number of outgoings, and they're going to have to, you know, they're going to have squad players, or they're going to have to bolster certain departments to provide competition there. Well, we spoke months ago and agreed that there are only two forwards who are absolutely certain of staying at United next season, which were Garnacho and Hoyland. Everyone else, there is a question mark over whether it's Pellistri or Ahmad, Sancho or Rashford, Anthony Martial will go, of course. I've probably left someone out, but the fact that you've even got Bruno Fernandes, you know, speaking on the record in his mother tongue, talking about the possibility of not being at United next season, it's almost a case of the way this season is going in particular. It feels like rats are looking to leave a sinking ship. And I think some of the players, and I'm not for 1 minute saying that Fernandes should be anywhere near that queue for outgoings, but some players will be easier to shift than others. With some, there's just no market there. But I do find it interesting that after this complacent culture that Ed Woodward pioneered of just giving, doling out contracts to Tom, Dick and Harry to make it look good on the asset sheet and all this nonsense, and then you end up being saddled with players who have long outstayed their welcome, United should be putting players on trial, especially after the season they've had. And there's a lot of minutiae involved with it, because I think some people would look at it and think, well, why is Onana deemed not for sale yet? Diogo Dalot is, even though they've both got the same length of contract. The difference with Onana is that he's slightly older. He was bought last year, and there's no way United are making a profit on him. With Diogo Dalot, he's 25. They only paid £19 million for him in 2018. He's worth at least double that. So if, and I think in the case of Dalo, it would be a big if, a club were to offer United £40 million plus for him, you would be remiss to turn your nose up at that. You would have to consider that. And I think it's the right way to operate. I've always thought it's a strange comment in football when managers say X player is not for sale. Every player is for sale if there is a club out there that is going to be daft enough to chuck money at them, whether it's, Lionel Messi or Ellis Sims or Aaron Wan-Bissaka. I mean, that's quite the dinner party guess there that I've just come up off the top of my head. But whatever standing of player, there's always a price. And I think fortunately, that watershed summer of 2017, if things do feel calmer right now, maybe it will get crazier again when the season ends. But the days of club spending, I mean, it was par for the course in 2017 and 2018 that clubs wouldn't think twice about spending nine figures on a player. And United were going in that direction with the signing of Pogba for £89 million in 2016. And they actually committed a club record fee for Lukaku. I think that was £75 million, rising to £90 million a year later. But January showed how PSR, profitability and sustainability rules, are working. Because it is an effective deterrent. Clubs did think twice about making moves for players in January. It will be different in the summer, because that is the optimum time for teams to strengthen their squad and to rebuild or retool, whatever, however way you want to phrase it. But I would still be surprised. I mean, that's why I wrote in the week, is they're not going to just cap it at three signings. They want three key signings, and then the onus is on them to get good money for certain players who they will want to sell and will sell, and then use those funds to finance other incomings.
Yeah, this is going to be the challenge, isn't it? That is, because they've missed out on the Champions League, they might miss out on the Europa League. Yeah, we know they're pretty tight with profit and sustainability. It is almost a sell to buy window in terms of having to do what they want to do, which puts some pressure on that new football department and whoever's going to be heading it up over the summer, which is why Onana, Hoyland, Garnacho and Mainoo are essentially the only players not for sale. But the challenge is, I guess, that the players they would like to sell are the ones that are probably going to be most difficult to sell. And it's going to be really interesting to see how successful they are in raising money through sales this summer, because it's an area they've not always been strong at. It's a very difficult market to sell in at the moment, given so many Premier League clubs are struggling with PSR. The European market has shrunk quite rapidly. So incomings are the ones that are always particularly exciting, but it's what United managed to do in terms of the outgoings this summer that's going to be crucial to what they can do in this window as a whole, isn't it?
It is. And even with players who I think will be sold, I don't necessarily think there's a really big market for them either. So you are still, United could be quite reliant on just having a good relationship or good dialogue with a small pool of clubs regarding a certain player. I mean, Wan-Bissaka has to be sold this summer because he's out of contract next year and they have to get money for him. And it will be a loss, of course, because in terms of how much they paid for him, it was 45 million, rising to 50 million in 2019. They would do well to get £20 million for him. I think that's got to be a starting point as far as negotiations are concerned for a 26-year-old right-back who's Premier League proven and played for United for 5 years. If they were getting below £20 million, that would be a form of failure, I'd think. But when you consider Wan-Bissaka's personality, his character, his background, ideally, you would look at London clubs, because he was a little bit homesick when he first came to Manchester. And of course, he's grown up in London playing for Palace. West Ham were interested in him last season in a loan deal midway through, and you thought that made sense. And you're looking at that kind of profile of club, would Crystal Palace really want him back? They've been playing Nathaniel Clyne recently, so that would suggest they do need a younger right back in. I think Joel Ward still is knocking about at Palace as well, so returning to sender is probably an advisable strategy there. And United are going to have to swallow their pride at times in terms of the fees they're going to get for these players. I mean, Pellistri is playing regularly on loan at Granada, but everybody knows that it would be a surprise if he signed for Granada permanently, because Spanish clubs, so we're told by people at United last year or earlier this season, are skint apart from the major clubs, Barcelona, Real Madrid and Atletico Madrid. And that's a similar problem with Greenwood as far as Getafe are concerned, in that those clubs, that these players are at these clubs with a view to getting a move to a bigger club, and you have to look possibly outside Spain in the case of Pellistri and Greenwood to find a buyer. But Pellistri costs £9 million. They've got to be aiming to maybe even double that in terms of the asking price, maybe an overall fee of doubling it, just because of the clout he has at international level, having played at a World Cup, and he's done quite well in La Liga by all accounts. Greenwood, that's a difficult one for someone who's not played Manchester United in more than 2 years. And there's also there's the background as to why he's not played for United and why he may never play for United again and should never play for United again. And you look at Victor Lindelof, he's also out of contract next year. He absolutely has to be sold this summer, because you're not going to give him a new contract. He's only turning 30 in July, so there's resale value there. again, they're not going to get anywhere near what they paid for him in 2017, understandably. But he's a ball-playing centre-back. There have got to be some teams in the big five leagues who would welcome a ball-playing centre-back who also has experience of the rough and tumble of the Premier League. But going to a league with a more sedate pace, I think it's a pretty logical it's a logical strategy. And let's not forget that the onus is also on the agents of the players. The agents have got to do their fact finding and touch base with clubs and gauge which clubs are receptive to doing a deal and feed that back to United while United are doing their own due diligence. It's a little bit similarly to 2022. There are going to be a few players who are released, but it's not, if back then it did feel like they were clearing the decks because they were quite high profile departures in Pogba, Lingard, Mata, Cavani and Matic. This summer, I mean, Johnny Evans, if he does go, he's only been back at United for a year. Rafael Varane is a high profile player, but he's been so brittle that it feels almost quite natural to let him go. Anthony Martial is possibly the most high profile just because he's been at United the longest. But the fact that he's been at United for 9 years is its own story in itself. But at least United can finally cut the cord this year. And then after that, it's quite low level players. Tom Heaton, who is open to stay in possibly with a coaching role tagged onto it. Is a third choice goalkeeper. Brandon Williams hasn't played this calendar year and was seen in court recently. He's probably had one substitute appearance for United in nearly 3 years, I think, due to being on loan at Norwich and then Ipswich this season. I'm not too sure who else there is that they can release. I think there are one or two others. Omari Forson, who had that rather surprising full debut against Fulham and didn't cut it and has not had too many opportunities since. And it doesn't seem like there's been any headway over a new contract. But I think that's another telling aspect about the whole restructuring of United and the new approach. This is the first season this century that there hasn't been an in-season senior contract announced, which it's quite a staggering departure from the norm. When I thought about it, I thought there must have been a season this century at least where they quietly nobody signed a new contract, but there literally hasn't been. There's always been an in-season contract announced for a senior player. This season, there hasn't been a single one. Rashford was, of course, in pre-season, and that was the last major one that United announced.
Yeah, which is quite incredible, really, and probably a positive sign. And I guess the one interesting aspect of those departures is that Fernandez, the club captain, isn't seen as entirely unsellable. And then in typical timing, does an interview with DAZN in which he kind of hints he might consider his future after the Euros. I mean, he's almost certainly been United's best player this season. I guess he's one of the few assets also that you could attract a fee for. I mean, you could see him playing for another elite European club, but it's going to take a mighty offer surely for United to consider selling Fernandez, unless he does decide that he's been here long enough. I mean, he's been here four and a half years at the end of the season. And you can't really fault Fernandez's performance levels through much of that, really. For a team that's been in flux and transition for a lot of the time, he's kind of been the one constant, hasn't he?
He has. And as you said, the timing, I don't think it was a coincidence. And excuse me, the fact that interview was conducted in Portuguese as well. I mean, when I saw the quotes, I thought there's no way he said this to an English or a British journalist or a British broadcaster. And so it turned out to be that he was speaking in Portuguese, and players naturally feel a lot more comfortable expressing themselves more candidly in their mother tongue. And I mean, Fernandez is a really good talker in English anyway, but the fact he went that way, that he went that far regarding his own future, I think was quite telling. What I'd say about it is that I don't think Ineos or whoever's in place for the structure at that point, they can't be delaying decisions regarding players until after the Euros. It's got to be made now. And fair enough, things can change. A bid could come in on deadline day for Mason Mount that's £70 million. And you're not going to say no to that. Not that that's ever going to happen, but you've got to be prepared in any scenario. With Fernandes, I guess because he's turning 30 in September and he will have decent resale value because of his performance level and his status as United's captain and just one of the best best playmakers, attacking midfielders in Europe, that there would possibly be another elite club out there who could afford his wage demands, who would go for him. But I still struggle to identify which club that would be. I mean, PSG seem to be shying away from superstars. Not that Fernandes is a superstar, but I think he's also one who's got the right mentality, and I think he would actually enhance PSG. Barcelona, with their finances, what's going on there? Would they accommodate a big buy like that? I have my doubts. Do Real Madrid need him? No, not with Jude Bellingham there playing in between Rodrigo and Vinicius Jr. And then you've got a pretty extraordinary roster of midfielders to underpin those attackers there. Italy is not, it's not the attractive league it was in the 90s or the 80s or even the early 2000s, probably before the Calciopoli scandal in 2006. So certain players, I think they have got limited options, and it doesn't feel like it used to in the early 2000s when Real Madrid would be quite actively looking at players at United and liking the look of them, and or even with David De Gea, of course, that air of inevitability of a Latino player who goes to United from a smaller club and then he's bound to go to Real Madrid at some point down the line. It doesn't feel that way anymore. We've kind of half jokingly said that Garnacho will end up at Real Madrid, and I think there's every chance that that will happen at some point in his career. He's certainly young enough, and I think given that he was born in Madrid, came from Madrid, and was in Atletico's youth system, there'd be logic to him, and it'd be understandable if he had the ambition to want to do that. But Real Madrid is so much better than Manchester United now as well, that why would you look at a club who are as erratic as United and frankly as unsuccessful as United in recent years and think, yeah, I'll have that player or that player? You can't cherry picking Manchester United players. It used to be impossible, as much as clubs would have loved to have done it. Now it's possible, but I would imagine quite a lot of elite clubs don't want to do it. I mean, Real Madrid sell their players to Manchester United. Manchester United don't sell their players to Real Madrid. That's how it works now, because Real Madrid is so much better, and they call the shots, and they're happy to call time on certain players' careers at the Bernabeu, as they have done with Di Maria, with Casemiro, and with Rafael Varane. And none of those players have been an outright success. You've gone from, Di Maria was an absolute flop. Varane has been decent for United when he's played, but he can't be a success because of the injuries. Casemiro was a success last season. He's not been a success this season. And then just looking lower down the food chain, I mean, Donny van der Beek, I think it's safe to say that Eintracht Frankfurt won't be taking up their option to buy him. And in terms of the amortisation of that deal, as we were discussing yesterday, I think that was £35 million up front in 2020. So dividing that by four, because he'll have been there come 4 years, come the summer, you're looking at around £8-9 million to let him go. There would still be some clubs who think, why would we part with £9 million for a player who has been as anemic as he has been over the past 4 years?
Yeah, absolutely. Going to be an interesting and probably a tricky window. That's all for the first part of the Manchester Red podcast. We'll be back after the break to talk about some breaking news from Old Trafford on Tuesday night. Welcome back to the Manchester is Red podcast. Tuesday night, late on Tuesday night, while most of the football world was watching Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, United confirming that Patrick Stewart, the interim chief executive, and Cliff Beattie, chief financial officer, are leaving at the end of the season. Jean-Claude Blanc, a name kind of well known in Ineos circles recently, the chief executive of sport at Ineos, is stepping in as chief executive until July the 13th, when Omar Berardo will start. Roger Bell, another Ineos Sport, I think he's chief financial officer of Ineos Sport, is now becoming chief financial officer for United. So a few more Ineos-led changes. The CEO position, obviously quite interesting, given it's, what, two and 10 weeks maybe that Jean-Claude Blanc will do that role for. I mean, Samuel, fill us in on kind of why those changes have been made and what we know about them and what it means, I guess.
Yes, I was disappointed in whilst enjoying Bayern Munich Real Madrid that message pinged, and as always you see the identity of who sent the message, and you know that there's going to be some news here, and I suppose that it's not a shock. Certainly Cliff Beattie, I hesitate to say unfortunately, because I'm not being mean, but he does bear resemblance to Joel Glazer, and I'm pretty sure, yeah, Getty have captioned him as Joel Glazer as well once or twice. And he joined United in 2016. He's just another of these board members who you knew that they were bound to leave when Ratcliffe completed his minority stake. So it's logical that he goes, given that Ed Woodward left 2 years ago, Richard Arnold left last year, Matt Judge went in 2022, John Murta resigned last month. These administrators or these board members who were part of that era, hardly any of them are left anymore. And I know there are still a few kicking about, and I'm sure not as high a level, but low level, but I suspect there'll be a couple more noteworthy changes, certainly from our perspective. And with Jean-Claude Blanc, he was with Ratcliffe, and I think Andy Curry, is it Rob Nevin, is the other guy from Ineos, so Dave Brailsford, when they visited Old Trafford and Carrington in March last year as part of that Ineos delegation, and they met Richard Arnold and the chief operating officer Colette Roach at Old Trafford, and then they went on to Carrington, had a look around there, and spoke with John Murta and the other people who were relevant. I mean, there was the Jimmy Murphy Centre, which is where the press conferences are held. That was there were a few press conferences that weren't held there because it was where United used that to present to Ineos and to Sheikh Hasim's delegation. Not Sheikh Hasim, of course, because we still don't know if he exists. But with Cliff Beattie, I was told some time ago that he was, you know, one of the driving forces behind a lot of senseless contracts that were doled out because it looked good on the asset sheet. It maintained the value of the player when all it did with a lot of those players was just, and United were left saddled with them. They'd outstayed their welcome and they couldn't shift them. You think of Marcus Rojo, Phil Jones, Eric Bailly. You think of Anthony Marshall this summer as well. He's going to be released 5.5 years after signing his last contract. And very rarely do United make a profit on signings they've made, or if they renew a player's contract, do they end up getting a good fee or good value for money? Probably not. I think Anthony Elanga and Dean Henderson last year were players that they could have, maybe not so much in Elanga's case because he was so peripheral under Ten Hag, but Henderson, I think it was a 15 million rise into 20 million pound fee, which was really quite pitiful. And but in terms of getting those players tied down on contracts, don't think anybody quibbled with that because they were academy players and they were young. But when you're giving Phil Jones a contract when he was approaching the final 6 months of his previous deal that had a plus one option of it on it as well, you're inclined to ask, what the hell were they thinking? What the hell were they doing? Even Phil Jones's representatives were surprised to, you know, be summoned to the table and discuss new terms. They thought that they'd they'd see out the season, and then it would get to the summer and they'd make a decision then, because they just assumed the plus one option would be triggered. So we've gone through the mismanagement of United in chapter and verse. I suppose with Blanc, he does have big club experience of having been at Juventus and Paris Saint-Germain. It's been suggested it was more on the commercial side, but he's been at Ineos for a while. He's as you said, he's the sporting chief executive. He's on the football board with Sir Dave Brailsford, which almost looks almost like a token gesture that the football board at United doesn't have any real power whatsoever. It's certainly for a while it's just come across as a bit of an old boys club, with Sir Alex Ferguson, David Gill and Mike Edelson being on there. But with these changes, United have said that they want a more performance-driven environment. And that's you only have to look at Ineos's sporting ventures to know that there is definite drive there. And the fact that United are having to say they want a performance-driven environment, it does somewhat remind me of previous people who are no longer at the club but used to say, the football is the priority. And I think one of us told him that you're the only football club that has to stress that the football is the priority, that it's the focus. And the more he said it, the more we thought it probably isn't the main focus under the Glazer family. Fortunately, I do think that is genuinely changing with Ratcliffe, who's come in and he wants a new stadium. He wants to knock Liverpool and City off their perch. And he needs best in class, and he clearly is favouring people that he trusts or who are familiar to him from Ineos. Although it's quite a broad church, I suppose, in that Sir Dave Brailsford comes from a very different background to Jean-Claude Blanc, and then you've got the financial executives who've been with him for years at Ineos, and then Omar Berada, who's come in from Manchester City. He's one who's really going to be the driving force behind the change that Ratcliffe and Ineos oversee in the coming years. Jason Wilcox is come in as technical director from Southampton as well. So I think some people may look at it and think it's cronyism. It's just a bunch of guys from Ineos who are being named on the board, but there's a reason, there's a reason why Ratcliffe is valued at 29 billion pounds last year. Ineos have been successful as a petrochemicals company. They've been successful with their sporting ventures, and so far they have talked a pretty good game. And going for Dan Ashworth as sporting director as well is a laudable move. I think everybody, whether you're a United reporter or whether you're a United supporter, I think everybody's behind that move, because it's one of the best in class sporting directors. And it's now is a case of just, I suppose, getting the band together and then trying to play a tune.
Yeah, absolutely. It's these moves, I guess, are another example of Berada maybe pulling a few strings while sitting in his garden and having nicer weather to sit in his garden. You mentioned there Dan Ashworth, someone else who's spending a lot of time in his garden. And I was told that he's been watching his son a lot as well, I believe, who's on loan at Bolton this season. So he's not been too far away from United and Old Trafford with those visits to Bolton. But he is kind of the one we're waiting for now, isn't he? We've got a start date for Berada. We haven't got a start date for Ashworth. The negotiations with Newcastle appear to be going nowhere. And I mean, the longer this goes on, it seems the less influence he's going to have over that transfer window, because we are at the point now where clubs are pretty much getting their ducks in a row for the window and knowing what's what. And at United, it's Dan Ashworth who's going to be the sporting director. We're no closer to knowing exactly when he's going to fill that post.
Yeah, I think we knew some time ago that he wouldn't have any official bearing on the summer transfer window, which is a pity for Ratcliffe and Ineos, because time is of the essence, and Ratcliffe is certainly a man in a hurry, and there is the opportunity as well with Klopp leaving Liverpool in the summer, and next season could potentially be Guardiola's last season, that you want to be as best prepared as possible to capitalise and to to try and end both of those eras, or you know, try and start a new era of success for United. But I still think that, you know, from what I've been told, like, Berarda has been working. He's been networking. He's been maintaining contacts. He's been checking in. I think, as Ratcliffe said, you know, Manchester City have been very grown up about it, and I think they accept, you know, that's the game, and they know the game, as one of our colleagues quips quite regularly, or quotes another colleague who has absolutely no idea about it. That's that's an in joke that I won't go on about much more. But you know, that's yeah. I suppose with Ashworth, you know, I do think that he's, you know, I think that there was the story, was it last month, that Mike McGrath did, that he was a guest at to Dave Brailsford's birthday dinner. Mm. I mean, I don't think anybody thinks he's not talking about Manchester United with people at Manchester United, or he's not having some kind of bearing, or he's not offering some sort of advice, even if he has to use a burner phone to do it rather than a traceable phone, who knows. But they, I suppose if things go all right next season, or things haven't improved enough, then Ineos can always say, well, we had to wait to get the structure in place. And Ratcliffe did express that frustration after he completed the London Marathon a couple of weeks ago on the BBC, when he said, you know, that all these people they're on gardening leave. So he gave the impression that their hands are tied, and officially their hands are tied, because Berarda isn't starting until mid-July, and Ashworth is not even technically, there's nothing signed there. He's not completely certain of becoming United sporting director, but everybody expects he will eventually become United sporting director.
Yeah, absolutely. That's all for part two of the Manchester Red podcast. We'll be back after the break to talk about Jadon Sancho. To the Manchester is Red podcast. Champions League semi-final week, of course, and you might not know it from Manchester United's official website or any of their social media accounts, but they do have a player in the semi-finals. Jadon Sancho, representing Borussia Dortmund tonight, if you're listening to this podcast on Wednesday. If you're listening later in the week, then you will already know what has happened. But Sancho, one of four or five English players still playing in the knockout in the semi-finals. You've got long odds on United still having Champions League involvement in the semi-finals when they fluffed the group stage back in the autumn, but that is the case. Like I say, it's going completely under the radar in terms of United mentioning it, the fact that a lone player is at this stage of the competition. But there is some relevance to it, really, isn't there, Samuel? Not just in the money that United could make. I think if Dortmund reached the final, then United might be looking at a profit from the Sancho loan deal, which will be valuable at a time of PSR, even if it's only a small one. And it's also a perfect shot window for Sancho to try and put himself out there, isn't it? Because a return to United still looks pretty unlikely.
Well, he said that Dortmund is home when he returned there in January, and United need to be engaging them again to see if they will pay a fee for him to re-sign him. I know that Dortmund is not, it's got quite an average, I think the average age of that area in Germany is quite old. And so it's not a place where young players normally go to see out their careers or spend their core years of their careers. But Marco Reus has, I suppose, although he's a boyhood Dortmund fan. Mats Hummels has gone back there as well, having defected to Bayern Munich. And really, if they're a club that are in the Champions League semi-final, and certainly with the Bundesliga, with Leverkusen winning it this season, does that throw up the prospect of it being a more open title race next season, or is more normality going to resume? I don't know. But Sancho clearly has a much stronger bond and connection with Dortmund than he does with United. And he seems to have done I mean, certainly going off the Champions League form, it's good going to have got to a Champions League semi-final, and the manner in which they did it as well was particularly impressive. I mean, Atletico Madrid are a very tough nut to crack, as United discovered a couple of years ago in the round of 16, but Dortmund scored, what was it? Was it four or five goals against them across the two legs? And really, when you've got one of the average, I think they still must have the highest average attendance in Europe. And if you get into the Champions League semi-finals as well, and if you're not in this cycle that they used to be when Bayern Munich would just sign all their best players, whether it was Götze or Lewandowski or Hummels, then I think they should be able to afford him. And again, that word amortization, if we're going off that and the fee that United paid for Sancho in 2021, which was £72.9 million, come the summer, he'll have been at United 3 years, the golden number would be £30 million. And I would imagine Dortmund should be able to afford that, given the Champions League run they've gone on this season. And as I said, that they pack out Signal Iduna Park every other week. It's always got 80,000 fans inside it. So it is working out for him. I don't think it's been a spectacular loan. I don't think it's quite been Jesse Lingard at West Ham. Not that that was quite the level that Sancho's operating at in with Dortmund, but that's got to be a deal that United look to do. And really, I remember writing back in September after he'd been exiled that he immediately viewed Dortmund as a possible exit route. Another one was Nottingham Forest on the strength of Steve Cooper, his old England youth team coach, being the manager there. But of course, Cooper was sacked long before the January transfer window. So it worked out in that United got a loan fee. Dortmund have covered a portion of Sancho's wages. And, you know, I suppose maybe his salary would be a bit of a stumbling block, because I can't imagine Dortmund would be prepared to pay him 200 grand a week, which whatever he's on at United, I think it's something like that. But if he's happy being back in Dortmund, I'm sure there could be a compromise.
Absolutely, yeah. And that still seems the most likely outcome, that the working assumption at United is still that he will be sold. Even if Ten Hag goes, it's difficult to see a way back for Ten Hag, for Sancho at United, isn't it? It isn't just Ten Hag that he has annoyed during his time at the club. He has underperformed here. And it probably doesn't reflect brilliantly that he finds life easier and the football more enjoyable in what is a fairly low-profile environment compared to United, where he seemed to struggle to ever settle and kind of show his best football and play with that freedom that we always saw at Dortmund.
Yeah, Rangnick said this, and Rangnick did get a tune out of him as well. He played, I'd say, Sancho's best spell of form was under Rangnick, probably between February and March 2022. But I think some of us did write at the time that he was going into a pressure cooker environment at United, having been in an environment where there was next to no pressure at Dortmund, who until this season, they almost always went out of the Champions League at the round of 16. They never challenged for the Bundesliga title. Every season it was finishing the top four, which they almost always do, and maybe win the German Cup. There's a reason why Sancho, Haaland and Bellingham went to Dortmund, but we're not going to stick around for too long. And I think in the end, Sancho was probably the one who spent the longest there of those three. So he's possibly because of that, he's the one who's most attached to them. Haaland was only there for 18 months. Bellingham was there for what? Was it 3 years, I think? Yeah, just I think it was about 3 years. So Sancho was, he's, as I said, he's attached to them. But that was always going to be the real test of him. And I did think when he made his full debut against Wolves, the way he operated, it was really, really, it was strange. It was far too slow. When a winger gets the ball, you expect them to be operating at near breakneck speed, because pace is essential to their game. But whenever I watch Sancho, or certainly a lot of the times I watch Sancho, he reminded me of Dimitar Berbatov, in that he'd get the ball and he'd want to slow it down and he'd want to take his time. And with Berbatov, there was some method to that, even though it did wind up a lot of United fans. But with Sancho, it was just jarring to see that from an early 20-something winger who, when you looked at the highlights package from his time at Dortmund, he did operate at breakneck speed. But it's almost like with Dortmund, he was just playing in a... It's like a kid playing in a playground. You just play with abandon. You're enjoying yourself. There's no pressure. And then at United, he's almost looked like someone who's permanently on trial. And even before this season, last season, he took 3 months out to regain his focus, to regain fitness, whatever it was. I mean, both of us have written a hell of a lot about that. He came back and he did pretty well initially as well. I thought he actually did well in that February after his reintegration into the first team squad and his reintroduction to the matchday environment. But it's just clear that he's not cut out for it at Manchester United, and that probably drew that conclusion last season, despite him coming back in and doing quite well. I thought the FA Cup final was a real I think the die was probably cast that day, because that was him starting a final which he wasn't going to start until Anthony got injured maybe a week or two before, against his former club. Can you prove a point? And he was anonymous. He had a really, really bad game. I think when Stephen and I were talking about that final lineup, we were going through it. I think I'd named 10 and I couldn't remember the last one. It was Sancho, and that's because he was that forgettable that day.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a very disappointing day for him. Right, that's all for the midweek edition of the Manchester is Red podcast. Samuel, yourself and Stephen, I think, will be back on Friday to discuss whatever breaking news happens in the next 48 hours. I'm sure there'll be something. There always is at Old Trafford, and to look ahead to the trip to Palace on Monday in more detail. But thank you for your time today.